From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. Jeremy Hobson is off today. This is Here and Now. The unrest continues in Venezuela, where a manhunt is underway today for a band of anti-government fighters who attacked an army base early Sunday morning. Government troops killed two people involved. 10 escaped with a supply of weapons. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro has called it a terrorist attack and promised the maximum punishment. But a chorus of critics around the world say his tightening grip on the country is approaching a dictatorship. Andrew Rosati is a reporter for Bloomberg News, and he's with us from Caracas on Skype. And Andrew, the key question here is, who is responsible for this attack? Are they members of the Venezuelan military who've turned on the president, or are they civilian opponents?
Well, that's a big question, and we're not sure. At least one of the members detained yesterday was a member, an active member of the military. But the other handful of them, the president said referred to them as mercenaries, and we're not sure exactly what that means. It could lead they were civilians. The man said to be leading this attack was someone, a former National Guard captain. So we're not sure exactly who these attackers are yet, if they're paramilitary men, as the government has alleged, or it's a mix of civilians and actually military men.
The distinction is important because the opposition in Venezuela has tried to turn the military against Maduro. Is there any question now that the military is starting to move away from the president?
The opposition has long called on the military to break ranks, so to speak, and to follow the 1999 Constitution, which the opposition said is being trampled by this government. This attack comes 6 weeks after another alleged attack in Caracas by a kind of elite police officer who flew a helicopter and threw grenades over the Supreme Court in Caracas and fired live rounds in broad daylight. That man is also at large. Mm. Many people were confused by this in the sense that this is the man who acted in movies. He had a very glamorous Instagram account. This attack yesterday happened at night. It definitely caught the military off guard, as the president has said. But, you know, many people have told me on the street they're not sure what to believe. Caracas was mainly calm yesterday. There was some, you know, spats of protests yesterday, but much of the country seemed to be going on about their daily lives. So it's not to say that we're in this large-scale military uprising. It could be an indication that, you know, these protests are, like I said, becoming much more violent in concentrated centers around the country. We're not sure what to expect yet, but we're keeping a close eye on it.
Well, all of this is happening as the new National Constituent Assembly comes to power. It was sworn in last week. Those lawmakers are loyal to President Maduro, and they immediately fired the chief prosecutor, Luisa Ortega, one of the president's biggest critics. That in and of itself was a dramatic scene this weekend, wasn't it?
Yes, it was a very dramatic scene. And last week was, in general, was very dramatic. The fact that this assembly, the first order of business was essentially throwing her out of her office. The military surrounded it early Saturday morning, and she was unable to get back in. It shows that, in one sense, the government was doing much of what we were expected, but at the same time, the way it's cracking down on dissent here. The government has said this new legislative superbody is needed to sort of enshrine socialism and bring about peace to this nation. But the big fear is here that the government is going to become increasingly more authoritarian. The opposition even alleges that, you know, a dictatorship on its way. And all these things combined, many Venezuelans are incredibly weary and not sure what's coming next here on the ground.
Well, as you mentioned, there is a lot of uncertainty. The economy there is collapsing. There are food shortages. Inflation is a problem. And now we see yesterday armed factions appear to be attacking the military. Are people in Venezuela at all worried that the country is walking towards civil war?
You know, this is a topic of conversation you hear coming up more and more. Yesterday could be evidence that, you know, this is towing the line of a complete armed conflict. These men allegedly made off with a cache of weapons. And if this is true, and if they're dispersing these weapons, you know, this is certainly going to heighten the fears of average Venezuelans. All that being said, Caracas is back to work today, you know, but, you know, these things, you know, don't always happen without warning. And we will have to keep a close eye, especially what's happening around the capital, because this is where, you know, Valencia, where this attack was yesterday, Maracay and other cities, these are where these big army bases are. And if these attacks could increase, you know, it's very likely that they could happen outside the capital.
Andrew Rosati is a reporter for Bloomberg News. He joined us on the line from Caracas, Venezuela. Andrew, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, here in the U.S., violence is spiking in many American cities, St. Louis, Little Rock, Nashville, where in March, 19-year-old Vestoria Lucas was shot and killed near a playground in a public housing complex. She was a high school senior, a dedicated basketball player. The violence around her frightened her, and the brazenness of the killing shocked the neighborhood, which is grappling with the highest homicide rate in nearly three decades. Maribah Knight from Here and Now contributor WPLN reports.
At Vestoria Lucas's funeral, Pastor Howard Jones asked God to heal her grieving friends and family.
So, Father, help us to help each other.
He didn't want her murder, as so many do, to cascade through the neighborhood.
Father God, won't end just in a tragedy and another tragedy and another tragedy and another tragedy and another tragedy. Father, we want you to lead us, Lord, into a position of peace.
People in the audience nodded and shouted in agreement. Hands reached for the heavens. Everyone wanted what Jones was talking about, though a handful of them knew that lately, Vestoria hadn't felt much peace. In fact, she'd been preoccupied with death. It felt too close. First, her best friend and classmate, Dewan, was shot and killed. Then her neighbor, Cash. In January, she'd sent her sister, Christina Westbrooks, a message on Facebook. She wrote, "We never know. It might be one of us one day.
Just in case, I want to let you all know that I love you and I'm here for you."
10 days after Vestoria sent that note, a man named Jacques Clemens was shot and killed by a city police officer right outside her front door.
It hit her hard. After that, she's like, "I don't feel safe in this neighborhood." You know, she felt like something was going to happen to any one of us.
After Clemens' death, Westbrooks took Vestoria to a support group at a nearby church.
And she sat in the back. She did the meditation to, like, clear her mind. I don't know if it worked for her because the whole time her leg was just shaking. And everybody shared their, you know, emotions and their views and how they felt about stuff. And the lady asked her, she said, "What about you? How do you feel?" She said, "I'm angry. Tired of hitting the floor, tired of the gunshots."
I remember automatically being drawn to her because she was so silent.
Kadia Edwards, a local pastor and activist, was also at that same church meeting. When Vestoria did start talking, she confessed to having nightmares. Nightmares of her friends' bodies in coffins.
And I remember her vividly saying that she was having a difficult time sleeping at night. And she just said, "I feel like I'm next because I keep seeing people dying, and so I feel like I'm next."
When Edwards saw Vestoria again, it was at the funeral for Jacques Clemens. They were in line to view his body, lying in a lime green casket.
I walked up with her. I didn't want to look at the body, but she stood there for a while, looked at the body until we walked back around. I sat back down in my seat. She got right back up and went up there again and maybe stood, looked at the body again for what felt like another 3 minutes or so. And I remember saying to my friend, "I wonder what that's about." And so, I mean, my spirit was destroyed when I heard that not even a month later, she was killed.
On March 28th, just after 5:30 p.m., Vestoria was walking home from a game of pickup basketball. Police say a man named Kevin Smith approached her. He shot her 9 times in the chest, arms, and legs. A short time later, Smith was arrested and confessed to the killing. A felon who'd been in and out of jail, Smith knew Vestoria and her family. 3 years earlier, her mother says he'd assaulted Vestoria, and she'd fought back. But police say it's still unclear why he murdered her. On that day, Vestoria's neighbor, Marilyn Greer, was sitting in her apartment, talking on the phone. It was so beautiful outside, she'd opened her windows.
Was sitting in the window when I heard all this shooting, and, you know, about 10 shots, and it was just was different this time, you know.
Greer jumped up and ran outside, worried the victim might be her granddaughter. She had to get close to make sure it wasn't. Then she stayed, standing over Vistoria.
Myself and some other ladies, we just joined hands and just start praying over the baby as she was laying on the ground. We just started praying over her.
For weeks, Greer couldn't get the image out of her mind. Neither could the other women who prayed over the 19-year-old. At a vigil for Vistoria the day after, Pastor Edwards encountered one of those women. She was hysterical, convinced she couldn't wash the blood off of her hands, and worried she hadn't said the right thing to Vistoria in her final moments.
She was saying, "I didn't sleep last night. I keep seeing her face." There's something to be said about the nightmares that live inside of us after you've seen something so tragic.
Nightmares that get passed along, person to person, shooting by shooting. For Here and Now, I'm Mayor Benight in Nashville.
Heather Harpum's memoir begins with the birth of her daughter, Gracie, who was perfect. Heather was so happy. Yes, still devastated that Gracie's father, Brian, a mature writer who'd made it clear he did not want to have children, was not there. But pretty soon, Heather couldn't worry about that because her newborn was not perfect. Something was very, very wrong with her blood. And in a dizzying cascade of events, Gracie was whisked away. Ultimately, Heather was told she'd require blood transfusions just to stay alive. Brian came back into the family fold, and he and Heather were told Gracie could have a life-saving bone marrow transplant, and it would be best from a sibling. Ultimately, Brian and Heather had another child whose stem cells did save Gracie through the Pediatric Blood and Marrow Transplant Program at Duke University in Durham, North Carolina. But not before some happy accidents and some gut-wrenching decisions. Heather's memoir is Happiness, The Crooked Little Road to Semi-Ever After, and she joins us from the NPR studios in New York. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
In reading the book, I found at times I was gripping the book because I was taken along on this ride. What's going to happen next? Tell us, first of all, what did Gracie have?
Gracie had a blood disease which manifested as an inability to sustain red cells in circulation. It was never diagnosed. It was a fluke, a mutation. But the situation we were in ultimately became clear, which is that she was a child literally dependent on the kindness of strangers, meaning she had to have blood transfusions in order to survive.
And what would happen is that she would just become, as you wrote, she would become like a rag doll.
Yes. In the very beginning, I never had a newborn before. I didn't know what to expect. And so I just thought she was a kind of dozy, super easy, sleepy baby. But my mom was alert to just how inactive and inert she was and made sure we got back to the doctor.
Now, Brian is not there yet. You are in California having the baby. We'll skip ahead. You cocoon with your mom, terrific friends and family. He eventually does come into the fold. But you've got this thing to work through. You're still both now together dealing with a sick child. But you've got this lingering resentment that he wasn't there at the beginning.
Yes.
How do you resolve that?
First of all, you have to want to. And we don't always want to. I really wanted to. And Brian really wanted to. We both wanted to bridge the abyss. And there had been a connective tissue that remained between us, a connective thread, even when we were quite estranged.
Yeah. Well, then there was also Gracie. You both cared so much about her. As you write, a baby from central casting, really quite something, but with a time bomb inside. You and Brian, you write another point, had made someone with an expiration date. Because as she's getting older, you're finding out she could stay with the blood transfusions and live to 30 or have a bone marrow transplant. And the best matches are from siblings, although that's not a guarantee. But you were told you could do as some couples have and have another child to harvest their umbilical cord stem cells at birth to replace Gracie's.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about the decisions and the thinking you had to do there.
If you have one sick baby, the absolute last thing you want in this world is a second sick baby. And because we had no diagnosis for Gracie, we couldn't be given clear odds. And so we made a choice not to do that. And then luckily, Gabriel, our son, had other ideas and
that was incredible.
Made his way into this world.
You became pregnant again, kind of like by accident. So you didn't have to make the decision. Couples have made, you know, let us have a child to save the life of another child, to collect stem cells. You didn't have to make that decision because along came the child.
It was made for us. Right. Yeah, exactly. Along came a child.
But you then had to decide, do we go forward with this transplant?
The mortality risk for pediatric bone marrow transplant is quite high. The lowest that we were getting was a 10% mortality risk. And you're taking that up front. You're taking it right now. It's not a question of what will happen to your kid 15 years in the future. It's a question of will they survive this treatment right now.
Brian comes up with an incredible image. Because of the statistics, he says, imagine 10 little toddlers crossing the street. Only 9 get to the other side. I mean, that's what he presented to you. Do you mind reading from that point in the memoir, describing this debate you were having?
I'd be happy to. If transplant was a huge risk, so was doing nothing. When I thought of Gracie's future without the transplant, the screen filled with silent gray snow. I could see her at 4, maybe 5 years old, but that was it. Beyond that, she wavered out of sight. My gut feeling was that she needed this cure to survive. If we left her sick, I felt sure she'd get sicker. Failure to thrive. She could dwindle down, sputter out. He was afraid she would die if we transplanted her. I was afraid she would die if we didn't.
You decide to do it.
Yes, we do.
And then you move to the planet of people who are having stem cell transplants for their children. You enter this netherworld, literally go into a place where other families are doing this. Describe that.
It was stunning how ravaged, honestly, many of the children looked. Mm. It almost felt like being among beings who were experiencing things you don't see humans experience. I mean, things powerful enough and painful enough to transmogrify the body. And that was very sobering. Mm. It's one thing to decide in the abstract to take your beautiful little, you know, skipping 3-year-old daughter to cure her. And it's another to see kids who are in the middle of a brutal, brutal process.
Knowing that one child isn't going to make it across the street.
Those may well have been Gracie's odds, you know, 1 in 10 mortality risk. Our actual lived experience on the transplant ward was of a much higher risk level. Mm-hmm. There were 16 rooms on the ward where Gracie was treated, where she spent almost 2 months. By the time we left Durham and we'd been there 10 months, I could name a child from every one of those rooms who hadn't made it. Mm-hmm. And that was really hard to carry home.
And hard when you were there. I mean, Brian didn't want to get as close to the families that were there because he knew, you know, some of these parents are going to be shattered. You did and were shattered when some lost them. And meanwhile, your little girl, who is just a trip, starts getting deeper into the process and becoming one of those transmogrified, you know, losing her hair, losing any energy. She's having her bones emptied of their marrow.
That's right. You're being hollowed out like a straw person. At the same time, and she did go, I don't want to be blithe about what was really, really terrible, but there was this extraordinary spirit to observe in her, and I saw it in other kids too, this gorgeous lack of self-narration, if you will. Like, she could be so sick to her stomach, and then she'd wipe her mouth, and she'd pick up her ponies, and she'd go back to playing. Mm. And I was thinking, you know, if I'd been sick on that level, I'd be talking about it for a week. It would be the story of what was going on. I just can't believe it. I felt so sick. I was so sick. She just Like, that was then. I was just sick a minute ago. But now I'm going to motor my bed head up and the foot up, and I'm going to play around in this little valley that I've made out of my bed. You know, you look for whatever silver linings you can. That, for me, was one of those lessons. Like, hey, pay attention. You don't have to attach yourself to the story of how terrible this is. You can actually just try to live it moment by moment by moment.
And you do. There is a happy ending. There's actually a scene, both Gabe, you know, the little brother who gave his stem cells, and Gracie, who received them, are back in the hotel, and they've fallen asleep together. As you write, her fingers curled around his thumb. They didn't stir. They were busy doing the covert work children do at night, the multiplication of cells, the silent, unstoppable growth, the hatching of private plans. What I can't imagine didn't seem to you in that moment like a miracle. She's growing.
Yeah, it did. It still does. She's a beautiful young woman. It's both an absolutely ordinary reality and an astonishing, beautiful fact.
The book's title, Heather, Happiness. You take time throughout to try to decide what that is. What is that now?
You know it when you feel it. It's, of course, by nature, totally ephemeral, and it doesn't always come as the result of some perfect set of circumstances. It just doesn't. You can check off all the boxes and be miserable, or you can be, at least for a moment, on a pediatric intensive care unit and have a little exchange with your baby that brings you joy. So, gosh, I don't know.
It's a crooked little road, as you write. Heather Harpam's memoir is Happiness, the Crooked Little Road to Semi-Ever After. Heather, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Robin. It's been a pleasure.
New Orleans is struggling today in the aftermath of weekend storms that dropped nearly 10 inches of rain in parts of the city. Severe flooding followed, vehicles stalled, water rising up the sides of homes and businesses. Tegan Wendland is coastal reporter at WWNO in New Orleans. And Tegan, we know a couple weeks ago your city had another big storm. Flooding not as bad, though. So first, how bad was the rain this weekend?
So, Robin, every time it rains here, there's local flooding. People are used to taking precautions. We park our cars up on the curb so they don't get flooded out, avoid driving during downpours. But this was way worse than usual. The city was basically shut down. It took me over 4 hours to get to my neighborhood because so many streets were inundated. There were hundreds of cars abandoned on those streets and people wading through thigh-high water carrying dogs and babies. It was really apocalyptic.
Yeah.
I ended up canoeing around my neighborhood, giving people rides until 2 in the morning. And then I woke up on Sunday morning and the rain stopped and the water was gone. Trucks were towing the cars and people were picking up trash.
Okay. And it's got to be especially in New Orleans, right, where everybody, you know, is thinking how bad will it get post-Katrina. But officials today, we understand, are saying that anti-flooding measures worked, that the catch basins were largely cleaned. There weren't backups there. That wasn't the problem, that pumping stations were working. Is the thinking that this was just that bad a rainfall?
That's pretty much what officials are saying. We made major infrastructure improvements after Katrina, but this event really raised some questions. Is the pumping system we designed to protect us from hurricanes also protecting us from heavy rainfall? Is it working the way it's supposed to? And is it being properly maintained? So officials, you know, we just can't prevent flooding here all the time. The fact is we live below sea level and we live in a giant sinkhole. So it's just wet and that creates a lot of problems. The local advocate or the local newspaper, The Advocate, reports that this could actually be an upkeep issue. There are a lot of catch basins and culverts that are blocked up with debris from past storms. So the water couldn't drain.
Right. Okay. So it could be that those things weren't in effect. But the officials from NOAA said that some neighborhoods saw amounts of rain reflecting a 100-year event. That means there's a 1% chance of it happening in a given year. So if that's true, that you had one of those 100-year storms, it shouldn't happen again within this year. But are people fearful?
Right. I mean, that's according to science. That's how we come up with those calculations. We got 10 inches of rain in some places. There's more rain coming this week. And the fact is, we've gotten a lot of record-breaking storms over the past year. And scientists do tie increased rainfall to climate change, though, of course, meteorologists don't like to blame climate change for individual storms like this. But yes, I mean, it seems likely that we, just like the rest of the country, will continue to see heavy precipitation like this in the future.
Right. I mean, what scientists say about climate change is that it means just more extremes on every level. Is there something
Correct.
That New Orleans, in the minute we have, something New Orleans could be doing to improve things? Is there more infrastructure?
I mean, sure. We boast about the pumping systems that we built post-Katrina. Officials say everything worked as it should have. It was just too much rain and we weren't prepared for it. But city councilors want to know more. They're holding a meeting tomorrow to ask the city for answers, whether the pumping system really was working right. We've got $2 billion from FEMA for big infrastructure improvements across the city, roads and plumbing. But it takes time, and experts question whether these improvements are just another temporary fix.
Yeah. Tegan Wendland, coastal reporter for WWNO in New Orleans. Thanks as always.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's been a difficult summer for New York City subway users. Delays and breakdowns mean that stations are often crammed full of hot, frustrated riders stuck waiting for a train. Public officials are squabbling over how to pay for upgrades. Mayor Bill de Blasio is announcing a plan today that would increase taxes on the wealthiest families in the city. Couples earning more than $1 million a year or individuals making half that would pay half a percentage more in taxes each year. That money would pay for repairs and also fund a program to make half-price tickets available to low-income riders. But Governor Andrew Cuomo, who is officially in charge of the transit system, has his own ideas about funding improvements. And one of them is to sell the naming rights for transit stations. Cuomo said last month that private money has helped other public spaces.
We've done this in the park system. It worked. We've done it with historic properties. It worked. Now we should do it with the subway system.
Now, New York is far from the only city in the country considering deals like these. Mark Bartholomew is a professor at the University at Buffalo School of Law and the author of Ad Creep, The Case Against Modern Marketing. Mark, welcome.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
Well, I can tell by the name of your book that you'll be against these naming deals. But what is the harm? No one's going to argue that New York's subway system doesn't need this money.
Yeah, I guess I can point to at least two things. So one is the First Amendment, and that once you make one of these deals, the public entity really loses control over who gets to be part of these naming deals. They're really open to the highest bidder. And so you can see situations where maybe they inaugurate one of these programs, they have a corporate partner they like, but then someone else comes in, offers more money, and it could be a business with a somewhat unsavory character. It could be one that just doesn't seem to fit what New York City wants to represent to tourists and the rest of the world. But the First Amendment really doesn't let you pick winners and losers. So I think that is one problem.
Well, what's an example of that? You point to Portland, Oregon, right?
Yeah. So one example is Portland, Oregon, where they inaugurate a system where they would advertise on buses. And there was a marijuana supplier that wanted to advertise, and school kids take these buses. And Portland had to kind of throw up its hands and say, well, we don't have a right to block the marijuana advertiser, even though we're hoping for sort of a more genteel advertiser. The First Amendment means we really can't control who's going to advertise on our buses. Probably even more provocative than the Portland example is an Adopt-a-Highway program that was started in a southern state, and the Ku Klux Klan petitioned to be part of that program. The state tried to block them, but a court found, no, you can't block the Klan. They're just as much as anybody else who wants to participate in the Adopt-a-Highway program, they have the right to do so. You can see how that would be dissettling to maybe an entity once they started one of these naming rights programs.
But do you think that the cat is already out of the bag here? We've seen deals inked in Cleveland on bus routes in Philadelphia. Washington, D.C. is seriously considering them. It's pretty widespread already.
Yeah. It is. I think it's not completely a done deal yet because some places are resisting. So Los Angeles recently approved a proposal to sell off naming rights to their rail stations, and then they backtracked. And the reason they did so was precisely that First Amendment concern, the concern that do we really want to lose all control over who the private partners are who are going to be able to name these stations. So you're right. There's lots of these deals going around, and it's not just public infrastructure. It's schools. It's national parklands, state parklands. But at least I hold out some hope that some entities will realize, you know, there's a cost to this. It's not always free money.
So, sure, I hear the argument, but the reason that we're even talking about this in the first place is that Our public transportation system, for example, in cities across the country is woefully underfunded. The stations are in complete need of repair. Are you saying that the only solution then is to have the government fund these improvements entirely on their own?
So I think what you can say in response to that argument is, you know, there's been periods of ebb and flow when we kind of trust the government to run these kind of ventures and when we don't trust the government. And now we're at a particularly low ebb. But, you know, in all sorts of times in the past, there's been questions about, do we trust the government to pay for this? Is it worthwhile to use our tax dollars to pay for this, or is it not? And there are certain situations where it is worthwhile. You know, these are public infrastructure. They're important places economically. They're important places socially. And so sometimes, you know, we need a public solution to those sorts of things. I'll also point out here that although sometimes you hear about these naming rights deals and they really show eye-catchingly large sums, often we're not talking about tons and tons of money here. Sometimes these deals are made when you look at the fine print, and they'll help, but they don't help all that much. And so I think that brings the point into relief even more that, you know, this isn't a golden ticket. Even if you agree to some naming rights deals, it's invariably these large public infrastructure projects need public support.
Well, and to that point of the dollar amount, in 2009, the Atlantic Avenue Pacific Street Station in New York City was renamed Atlantic Avenue Barclays Center. That deal was $4 million over the course of 20 years. Does not seem like very much. But quickly, before we go, I want to ask you, you wrote this book called Ad Creep. What is the strangest place you've seen ads creep into?
I think one of the wilder ones is talking urinal cakes that sell to you while you're using the bathroom. That seems particularly invasive. Also, a lot of spaces that are captive, so gas station pumps and screens in doctor's offices and supermarkets, not just talking to everyone, but actually scrutinizing your face, looking at your facial expressions and delivering a commercial pitch based on what you look like. That's something new, I think, in the history of advertising.
Huh. That's Mark Bartholomew. He's a professor at the University at Buffalo School of Law and author of the book Ad Creep, The Case Against Modern Marketing. Mark, thank you.
Hey, my pleasure. Thanks.
Well, what if the risk of health problems like obesity and diabetes could be controlled in babies? And better yet, controlled before those babies are even born. That's the premise behind a new study in San Antonio using the youngest of volunteers. Wendy Rigby from Texas Public Radio has the story.
Ruby Gonzalez is only 4 months old. Already, she's part of important human health research.
So as a new mother, I want what's best for Ruby, and I know how much this research can benefit, you know, babies in the future.
That's Ruby's mother, Brittany Crump. She's one of the first 40 mothers to volunteer for a study taking place at San Antonio's University Hospital. It's well known diabetes runs in families. Now, UT Health neonatology professor Dr. Cynthia Blanco wants to know if genes that put people at risk for the chronic condition can be tweaked in infancy or before. When volunteer mothers give birth, Blanco and her team harvest cord blood for important genetic information.
In this study, we're looking at the entire genome of all of the babies and moms to try to understand if there's a particular genes or a group of genes that are actually getting interactions with certain nutrients.
In other words, it might be possible to head off diabetes in the future by controlling vitamins and nutrients in utero and beyond. Blanco explains.
We can only say, well, healthy diet. What does that mean, right? But if we say, hey, you probably need to just eat this one vitamin a little more or decrease this one thing, then that's easier.
The scientific approach is complicated, including sophisticated body analysis using body scans and a special device that measures the body composition of babies.
64.1.
Baby Ruby lies on her back on a track that slides her into an enclosed tube. It looks like a miniature pod you might see in a science fiction movie. After 2 to 3 minutes, the machine calculates air displacement and is able to give researchers a good idea of Ruby's body composition. One question to be answered, does a baby's body fat distribution drive their risk of disease later?
There's a lot of problems with obesity and diabetes.
Dr. Blanco says this work is critical since diabetes rates are rising despite current interventions.
We've done a lot of things to try to stop that, and things are not working.
The Centers for Disease Control has sounded the alarm about this chronic health problem in a report that shows if current trends continue, as many as 1 in 3 American adults could have diabetes by 2050. For Here and Now, I'm Wendy Rigby in San Antonio.
Google is in the headlines today because of an internal memo from a male software engineer who criticized gender diversity efforts at the company, arguing that there are fewer female engineers because men are better suited for the job for biological reasons. On Saturday, Google's new diversity chief, Danielle Brown, told employees in a letter that the memo had incorrect assumptions about gender that are not endorsed by Google. Let's take a look. Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic. He joins us as he does every Monday from New York. Hi, Derek.
Hello.
So this is a 10-page memo from an unnamed employee. You've seen it. As we said, the writer says women aren't as capable. Well, what else does he say about a move to add more women?
That is essentially the crux of the argument. His argument is that we don't see equal representation of men and women in tech and leadership because there is a certain distribution of talent between the genders that is not equal. Mm-hmm. And so organizations like Google, he said, should not try to fight biology. They should not try to fight nature. They should allow those inequalities to play out. Mm-hmm. And as you said, Google has essentially responded to the firestorm about this memo by coming out and saying in very clear terms, we disagree with the substance of this memo very seriously. And that is precisely why we've been trying to instill diversity efforts within the company.
Well, we understand the writer also says that this move for diversity discriminates against men and that there's a liberal bias that makes it difficult to even talk about this.
That's right.
At Google. That reflects the debate on college campuses about whether or not you can express, you know, even what some would see as ugly stereotyping opinions. Mm-hmm. Google's latest diversity report showed around 70% of its workers are male, but 56% are white, so they're more non-white workers. What is Google doing exactly to promote diversity?
They're doing a few things, and it should be said that that is roughly in line with the average of computer science degrees. It is heavily male, about 80% male, I believe, and about 60% white, and then 20% Asian, only 5% black. But what is Google trying to do is the question, and there's a couple of things. First, they're trying to raise awareness about something psychologists call unconscious bias. That is the idea that there are racist or racial biases that live deeply embedded in our brains, even if we don't act on them, even if we think that we are fair-minded. They're working on benefits to help their LGBT employees, encouraging Googlers to celebrate diversity. And they've also, to their credit potentially, published internal census or an annual census on its own diversity, even when the results of that census don't make it look particularly extraordinary for a tech company.
Well, but this is happening as the Labor Department is investigating Google over whether the company systematically pays women less than men, something that was found during an ordinary audit. So there's that. Former Google engineer Erica Baker told the website Medium she was disappointed but not surprised about this memo that went viral internally. And that what's new is that the employee felt safe enough to write this and send it out. But on the other hand, what does Google do? Do you, you know, banned opinions that, again, you think are ugly? Do you fire the employee? He didn't yell fire in a crowded theater. You know, what happens?
I think this is I think the issue of what do you do about these opinions is incredibly fraught. Because on the one hand, you know, what do you want from an organization that is trying to be creative at a top level? What you want is diversity of thought and diversity of background and diversity of ethnicity. You want all sorts of biological and ideological diversities. And it is true. There's lots of psychological evidence that points out that diversity in boardrooms and in conferences helps with creativity. But on the other hand, what happens when that freedom of expression actually shuts people down, mm-hmm. Makes certain people at Google less likely to be vocal because they're afraid that if they're women or they're minorities, that one of their colleagues thinks that they are there as an affirmative action handout and that they don't deserve the company of their colleagues. That's a terrible and pernicious thing to have within the company. So, of course, you want to encourage the freedom of expression. But as with everything, this is a bit of a dance and not an absolute dictum.
Right, right. And just very briefly, how do you increase diversity at these tech firms? Does it start with getting more women into the studies?
Yes, I think it has to do with both, you know, what does Google do in terms of how does it select people? But then it has to do with how do you increase the supply of people who are applying to Google and who are ready for it? So you have a bit of a distribution, or not a distribution problem, a pipeline problem. If only 20% of computer science majors in America are women, you've got to get that up. And that means maybe going down to, the kindergarten or elementary school level and encouraging women to keep studying math, keep studying science, not, you know, just give them magazines of princesses and say, this is what success looks like when you grow up, to show them that success for them can be on equal footing with men.
Right. Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. Derek, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And we'll keep an eye on that story. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.